You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 374, our 45th Q&A. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, what's going on?
Well, not a whole lot, personally. I mean, we're wrapping up the semester in a couple of weeks, and that means the summer will come, which means I get more time to write. So I'm glad, you know, that's sort of turning a corner. I always look forward to that.
Any writing? When you say writing, are we going to...
Oh, yeah.
Are we getting the prophecy, the astral prophecy book, or...
No. That's on the back burner. That's taking a back seat to some other things. That's about all I can say.
Even the novel?
Yeah, the novel I can mention. Yeah, that's part of it. But okay, yeah, there's some other things that I can't divulge right now.
Yeah. Well, that's good stuff. All right. Well, Mike, is there anything going on out there in the world, internationally or domestically, about biblical stuff?
Yeah. You know, I had a friend send me a link to a recent, study about the use of artificial intelligence and the Dead Sea Scrolls. The headline that they sent was AI unlocks ancient Dead Sea Scrolls mystery. So that's good for clickbait. But it's legit. You know, it's not just one of these, you know, sort of, you know, scam articles that are going to, you know, capture your information and send you all sorts of stuff you're not interested in. What it's about is that they're trying to apply artificial intelligence to recognize patterns in letter styles so that they can hopefully identify specific scribal hands in Dead Sea Scrolls. Because the article is a little bit misleading. Like it'll say something like, you know, all these Dead Sea Scrolls were written in an almost uniform style. Well, yeah, some letters, you know, but you know, when I was in grad school, we had to read, you know, things like Frank Moore Cross from Harvard. He did a very famous, now famous article on scribal hands, you know, paleography, letter formations. And he has a whole typology, and his typology was actually used to date Dead Sea Scrolls, because you could match the letter style to texts that had something in them that was actually datable, like somebody's name or some event. And his work has really stood up over, you know, over the test of time. So it's long been known that more than one scribe produced these things, even individual texts, that there were different scribal hands. So that's a little misleading. This isn't like the first time this is known, but what they're doing is they're using artificial intelligence to detect very specific, you know, minute changes in letter style, and essentially to search through scrolls for that and isolate which sections belong to which scribe, you know, scribe A or B or C or something like that. So it's interesting. You know, the results of it, I guess, if it's applied, you know, might tell you which scribe, in theory, it should tell you which scribe worked on which texts and where they worked. And then you can sort of, I don't know that they're going to do this, but you could sort of grade the scribes, like, okay, this guy's guilty of, you know, 15 errors, you know, in the scrolls. This guy only screwed up 8 times, so he's a better scribe than the first guy. I don't know what they're actually going to do with it as far as evaluation, but it's interesting. It's an interesting option of technology, you know, to get at this kind of information.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, AI is going to take over everything. So it doesn't surprise me that they would use that in the biblical world. It's probably going to unlock some kind of hidden Bible code.
Yeah. Right. Or at least provide material that someone can invent yet another Bible code.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's my money's on the invention side of it more than anything real and quantifiable.
Absolutely, Mike. Well, that's good stuff. Well, is there anything else going on in the world that you feel the need to talk about?
No, not really. No. I know we got some questions. What number of Q&A is this?
This is our 45th and 45.
Well, we're almost at like the golden anniversary of Q&As.
Are we going to get each other anything for our 50th?
Yeah, well, Maybe you can get me maybe an updated copy of Microsoft Word or something like that.
There you go. That'd be really sweet. Yeah, just really romantic.
Yeah, for our notes. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, hey, since this is a Q&A,
I
want to remind people out there that be collecting your thoughts on Revelation, because at the end of it, we're going to do a specific Q&A on Revelation. So email me at TreyStrickland@gmail.com with your Revelation questions. And if you could help me out, put Revelation in the subject line. I'm going to be collecting those, Mike, and we're going to try to tackle as many as we can at the end of Revelation.
Now, you know what's going to happen. You know what's going to happen with those.
What's that?
People are going to sneak in questions that to get at different end time systems. You know what? To see what I think about different end time systems. That's what's going to happen right there.
If you're
listening out there, and that's the plan, my answers are going to be real short. How many ways can I say I don't care? It'll probably have a little more substance than that. But I'm already on to you. If that's you, I'm on to you before we even get started.
Maybe we should just have a whole episode just where you tear down, break down specific end times prophecies, and then pick it apart.
Yeah, I've actually already done that on my website, drmsh.com, the series of Why an Obsession with Eschatology is a Waste of Time. So people can read through that, you know, and then they can take what's there, and they'll know how to argue against somebody else's position, but they'll also hopefully be awakened to the fact that, oh, somebody else could read this and argue against my position, you know. So, you know, I don't know that we need to repeat that. But see, that might be the answer to those questions. Oh, read number 6, you know, on the list of blog posts or something like that.
There
so
you there you go. Yeah, I forgot about that. So you're right about that article. But it would be nice to get it in podcast form too, maybe. Maybe not.
Well, maybe that'll be your 50th Q&A.
That'll be my 50th Q&A present, and I appreciate that.
Another Q&A. Yeah.
Sounds great. All right, Mike. Well,
I can hear the enthusiasm in your voice, you know, as we speak.
All right, Mike.
Try to contain yourself, Trey. Yeah.
Very hard to do, Mike. You're such a sweet.
Yeah.
I don't know where I'm going with that. All right, Mike. Hey, let's get through our questions here. We got some good questions.
Well, it ended well. Yeah,
we got some good questions from some good people here. So let's just get at it. Our first one's from Jason from Tempe, Arizona. And his question is, what does the Bible mean when it refers to gods that came recently? Deuteronomy 32:17 and Psalm 80:10 in the Septuagint. Does this recency refer to the glorification of beings that were previously in some way like humans, i.e. believers in the Most High God, who later were glorified and given responsibilities to protect and govern a subsequent generation of mortal beings? To me, this seems somehow like a repeating cycle, since Paul refers to believers being transformed at the second coming, 1 Corinthians 15:51. And John refers to believers as being called sons of God, 1 John 3:1. Recency of godhood is mentioned in the Septuagint Psalm 80, which in modern Bibles is Psalm 81. And Psalm 80:10 reads, verse 9, mm-hmm. There shall be no recent God among you, nor shall you do obeisance to a foreign God. What is it about the gods that make them not only created, but also recent?
Yeah, the answer to this is a lot simpler than the question might suggest. And Jason actually has the answer in the question. And that is Psalm 80, verse 10. So, you know, the talk about transformation, believers, you know, humans being transformed, it is all eschatological. There's nothing in Scripture that refers to this happening in the past. So the repeating cycle is just something that is sort of an idea imported into the text. There's really no basis for that. But the answer, again, is a lot simpler. The idea of recent gods refers to the gods. And just think of Deuteronomy 32, okay? Deuteronomy 32:17. They didn't, you know, worship God. They worshiped, you know, these other gods. They worshiped Shadim, you know, gods that they had not known. You know, and then again, you get this recency language in it. This refers to gods that Israel encountered since the Exodus period, as opposed to the God whom their fathers and ancestors had worshipped centuries prior to that. In other words, Yahweh. So to worship a different God than your ancestors did, that's a recent God. It's a more, you know, recent God. And by definition, it would be a foreign God. It would be a different God. And if you look at Psalm 80, verse 10, you know, which, again, you had read, but I'm going to read from the Lexham English Septuagint here. There will not be a new God in you, nor will you bow down to a foreign God. Well, there you have the new God language, and in parallel, it's parallel, the idea is to foreign. So new God, foreign God, right there's the answer in the verse. So these recent gods, these recent deities that Israel was worshiping and shouldn't have been worshiping, are gods that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and their forefathers, of course, at the Exodus, did not, you know, and so Deuteronomy 32, again, even if Moses wrote that, the answer is still, you know, pertinent because he's referring to the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You know, if somebody else wrote Deuteronomy 32, or again, there's, you know, this whole question of editorial activity in the authorship of the Torah, well, then we would loop Moses into that because obviously, you know, the Israelites coming out of Egypt are, they're going to go to Sinai, they're going to enter into a covenant with Yahweh. And the notion of, you know, Moses either forecasting that, you know, you're going to go after other gods, or, you know, that they in fact already have, depending again on the authorship, just, you know, speaks to the issue. Recent means he's, you know, this wasn't who your fathers worshipped. It wasn't who, you know, you entered into covenant with. Who are these newbies? You know, that sort of thing. So again, the answer I think is pretty more straightforward, or pretty much straightforward, than, you know, the question might suggest.
George from Woodsville, New Hampshire, asks, are there any female Upkalu? If not, how can Gilgamesh be two-thirds Upkalu?
Well, let's take the first part. I'm not aware of any iconography or anything textually that says there were female Upkalu. I know the implication of the second part of the question, if not, how can Gilgamesh be two-thirds Upkalu? Well, if both male and female Upkalu existed, Gilgamesh would be completely Upkalu. So that's one thing. But the reason why he's two-thirds is because the post-flood Upkalu, again, were in some cuneiform material, were quote-unquote of human descent. That's why you only get the two-thirds. And hence the parallel to Genesis 6, 1 through 4 that I've talked about in Unseen Realm and Reversing Hermon and the Demons book. All three of those books address the Upkalu context, which draws on the work of Amar Anus as far as the cuneiform material for this.
All right. Becky has a question about 1 Samuel 27, and I'm going to leave it up to you, Mike, to read the verses. But she wants to know, okay, so in the past, she just considered 1 Samuel 27 considered this straying from God, but now with the specific listing of the nations invaded, she wonders if this wasn't David carrying out the directions to Joshua to wipe out these nations.
Yeah, I think the verses were verse 8 and following, and I might as well just read those for the audience. So it says, now David and his men went up and made raids against the Geshurites, the Gerzites, and the Amalekites. For these were the inhabitants of the land from of old, as far as Shur, to the land of Egypt. And David would strike the land and would leave neither man nor woman alive, but would take away sheep, oxen, donkeys, camels, garments, come back to Achish, which is where he was, or at least the person, you know, he sort of was reporting to at this time in his life anyway. When Achish asked, where have you made a raid, you know, today, David would say, you know, this, that, and the other place, so on and so forth. So the rest of this we don't really need to read. It's really those first two verses. But he's going up making raids against the Geshurites, Gerzites, Amalekites, and then he strikes the land, would leave, neither man or woman alive. I tend to agree, you know, that what we have here, this edit, there's an editorial comment in here, and by that I don't necessarily mean an editorial hand. I mean just in the text. These were the inhabitants of the land from of old, as far as Shur. Okay. If you recall from the Exodus series on the podcast, we talked about the Amalekites, and they do have a relationship to the giant clans. So there you have your clues right there. This inhabitants of the land from of old, the reference to the Amalekites. their heritage, the Amalekites anyway, can be traced to the Horites. And if you want to listen to all that material, it's episode 283 on Exodus 17. So, you know, this is part, in that case, you know, it's sort of a precursor to what Moses and later Joshua are going to run into in the land as far as, you know, opposition from the giant clans. In other words, it seeds that thought, or what's going to become a recurring motif. And really, in my view, what really defines this, the rationale for the conquest in terms of, you know, the verbs of killing, you know, the cherem, the holy war, quote unquote, you know, those elements of the conquest are really about the elimination of the giant clans and those that, you know, are perceived to extend from the Nephilim. Now, what about the Geshurites and the Gerzites, though? So, I agree in principle that this is what's going on. And I think the Geshurites and the Gerzites are part of this. And there's actually a text critical issue that makes it really doubtful that this is going to sound odd, but that the Gerzites even ever existed. But let me just track through. So, you have two options on the Geshurites and the Gerzites. And I'm just going to read a little bit here. I looked up the both terms from Anchor Bible Dictionary, and this is actually going to be part of a presentation I gave a couple of years ago in Lubbock, Texas, when I went through the people group names. But ABD notes, quote, the inhabitants, you know, the Geshurites and Gerzites were the inhabitants of an area southeast of Philistia, between Philistia and Sinai, according to Joshua 13:2. When David fled from Saul and resided in Philistia by permission of Achish, which is 1 Samuel 27, he executed forays against the Geshurites and despoiled them thoroughly. Okay, and then another note from the same source, you have this, ABD writes, the inhabitants of a district, Geshur, bounded on by Gilead on the south, Bashan on the east, and Mount Hermon in the north, according to Joshua 13:11. They were Arameans who, with the Maacathites, remained Israel's neighbors on Israel's northeast extremity. So you get a connection there to the, in terms of the northern border with Bashan and Mount Hermon. So based on, taking this a little further, based on Joshua 12:5, 13:2, Joshua 13:11, Joshua 13:13, Lipinski in this article, I've referenced this article before on the podcast. This is Lipinski's article about El's abode. El, you know, the Canaanite deity, his abode, which is, he argues very, very effectively, was originally Mount Hermon. This was the seat of the gods all the way back to Sumerian times. And of course, this is right at the, you know, the border of Bashan, okay, the region of Bashan. So Lipinski writes, the biblical story, again, based on these passages in Joshua, implies the existence of Manassite settlements in Bashan, which should probably be linked with Jeroboam II's conquest in the area. In earlier times, this region belonged, at least partly, to the kings of Geshur, okay? Later, the Aramean kingdom of Damascus. The kingdom of Geshur, or Beth Ma'akah, extended for 40 kilometers north of the Sea of Galilee. So all this whole region, and that much, would of course, would be in the land, the parameters of the land that was promised to Abraham and his descendants. So consequently, the Geshurites were residents in Amorite territory associated with Sion and Og of Bashan, okay? Kings of the Amorites, Og was a giant, okay, the last of the Rephaim. Though the Geshurites, there's no verse that explicitly calls them Amorites, they are in this territory. This would mean that the first option, the Geshurites were inhabiting an area in the south near Philistia, is not really, you know, the point of the reference, you know, at least for, you know, the conquest narrative. So going back to Anchor Bible Dictionaries, those two options, it's really the second one that the Geshurites were talking about, were inhabitants of a district, Geshur, again, up toward the north. So, you know, how do we look at this? You know, we've got David going after these Geshurites, and you could argue that there were two separate groups, one in the south, one in the north. And so, you know, a scholar would look at this and say, well, the you know, the Geshurites, we have to keep these two groups separate, so on and so forth. But to me, that actually isn't that clear, because okay, you have Geshurites in both locations. I get it. One location is very obviously associated with the giant clans. The other location, again, is southeast of Philistia, between Philistia and Sinai. But you get this association with the Amalekites as well. So you have these people groups, one of them, at least clearly, the Amalekites, is part of the giant clan traditions, living together. So regardless of which set of Geshurites, you know, we're talking about, and if we're talking about Achish, who's down in the south, it would be that group. I still think you have a connection to giant clan thinking and giant clan people groups, that this association is still, you know, still legit. It has some explanatory power here. Now let's go to the Gerzites, and they're also mentioned in 1 Samuel 27:8. Now, if the above is correct, that the Geshurites, you know, about the Geshurites and all that, you know, what about this other group? Well, in fact, the Geshurites may never have existed. Anchor Bible Dictionary notes this. The scholarly consensus is that the Gerzites, unknown from any other source, not just in the Bible, but anywhere else, okay? Unknown from any other source, most probably did not exist. Already, the Masoretic text corrected the Kethiv reading, Gerzi, to the Karay reading, Gizri, okay? Gezrites, meaning the inhabitants of Gezer, which also is in the north, by the way. Now, what that means in English, let me just finish the quote. Gezer, however, lies much too far to the north to fit the context of this particular passage. Evidence from the Septuagint would indicate the Masoretic text reading either represents a conflate text representing two variants in Geshurites or Gerzites, Gezrites, or is the result of a ditography of Geshurites. Ditography means an accidental duplication of a term. Now, in English, what this means is that what the Masoretic text has, the way it's spelled, scribes themselves corrected so that it read Gezrites instead of Gerzites. The Kethiv reading is, Kethiv is a term that means what is written. In other words, what the text, you know, shows you, what you're looking at in the text. And then a scribe would in the column put a caray. This is what should be read. So here's what's written. Here's what should be read. So that, you know, the ancient scribal traditions actually already make this correction. And so, if the correction is correct, if we're dealing with people of Gezer, then there's no such thing as Gerzites. Okay, they're just people of Gezer. They're not some other group. So it would be a misspelling that has created this people group that we find in our English Bibles. Again, regardless, if it is the Gezerites, yeah, they're in the north. They're in the north, and they wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't really apply to, so the explanation goes, they wouldn't really apply to David's forays because David's operating in the south. Well, okay, how do we know that some people from Gezer, you know, weren't living down there as well? Well, the short answer is we don't. You don't have to have a city. You just have to have some people who, this is where they come from. They happen to be there when David does these raids. And somebody takes note of it. Again, whoever's writing, you know, 1 Samuel 27, that there were people from Gezer there too. And Gezer, of course, is included in the conquest, obviously the original, you know, conquest of the land. And because of its location in proximity to places like Bashan, and there are other reasons that, you know, we can't really get into all this in detail in the Q&A, but there are other reasons that they have linkages back into these giant clan traditions. Their inclusion in the idea, at least, still, you know, deserves attention, still has some merit. So anyway, again, that's kind of a long answer to this, to really the fundamental point of the question is what David is doing here is a sort of a mimicking of Joshua, kind of a wiping out. And a wiping up, if I can say it that way, of the conquest rationale, the conquest purpose in terms of the elimination of specific peoples because of the association with giant clans. And yeah, I think there's something to that here. And again, I think that little line in there, these were the nations of old, okay, I think is designed to take the reader's mind in that direction.
Bob has a question, and he wants to know that scripture tells us that we will rule with Christ after his second coming. My question is, what do we rule over? Since the unbelievers will be in the lake of fire and believers will be rulers with Christ, what will we be responsible for ruling?
I wish I had a dollar for every time I get asked this question. I could get you that anniversary gift then, Trey.
He asks,
you'd have what, $5?
No, I'd probably have $50.
Oh, okay.
He asked in the first part, what do we rule over? But then the second part of the question is really getting at who do we rule over? Those are two different things. You know, what we rule over is the earth, specifically the new earth, the new Eden. And yeah, it's going to be populated by believers, you know, with Jesus. You know, we need to stop thinking about our rulership in the new earth as who do I get to be the boss of, or who do I outrank, you know, and get to sort of give orders in a nice post-apocalyptic New Eden sort of way. You need to start thinking about the rulership in the new Eden as partnership. We are there with fellow believers. We're all equal imagers of God. We are co-rulers. We are, you know, with Jesus, we are steward kings. Basically what we're going to be doing in the new earth is, you know, quote unquote, ruling over the earth, which really means we're going to be living like Adam and Eve would have lived. And of course their children had there never been a fall. You know, Genesis 1:28, the dominion language there, let them have dominion over the earth. It's the same lemma in the Septuagint, anyway, as we see in Romans 15:12, where we have the Messiah again, and, you know, looping in the rule of the Gentiles, we're granted to rule with him in Revelation 2:26 and 3:24. So I think the whole question just needs to be reframed that, you know, when it gets to the end of the eschaton, when everything plays out, we have a new global Eden. Everything is going to sort of return, you know, hit the reset button to what it should have been, what it could have been without rebellion. And so we are going to be steward kings of the planet. We're going to enjoy it as it was meant to be enjoyed. And we are going to, you know, again, do the sorts of activities that Adam and Eve would have been doing in that environment together, collectively, as one family. So it's not that we have other people to lord over. It's that we have other people to rule with, you know, alongside of. So again, that's the short answer to that. There's a lot in there to unpack, obviously, but that's the short answer to, I think, a very reasonable question and a very common one.
So does that mean I got to start working out if we're going to be like Adam and Eve, where are we going to have clothes? Because I need to start working out.
You know, yeah, there you go. Yeah. No, yeah, it figures you'd pull something like that right out of the answer.
So you're telling me we're a bunch of nudists?
I'll say your glorified body will probably take care of that.
That's awesome.
You know, and if we want to get silly theological, you know, Jesus when in his resurrected body, he had new clothing too that he didn't have before. So you'll probably get new clothing anyway. So I don't think you need to worry about that. We'll still know it's you.
Well. I'll probably be in the
If you want a better body,
section.
Maybe you'll have one, but we'll still know it's you. Yeah, unless you want to be a nudist, I guess. You know.
Yeah.
Then you can, you're on your own there, Trey.
I'll be going, OG, me and Adam, you know, we'll be down by the beach.
I think the Lord will just take one look at you and say, well, there's always one of those in the crowd, you know, it's just, what are you going to do? Yeah. There's always somebody like that.
All right. Well, looking forward to it.
Even here.
Yeah. Well, looking forward to it. All right, Mike. Well, that's it, man. We got, we're in and out with this one. We only had those 4 or 5 questions. So we're going to be a short one today, but we appreciate you.
It's okay.
Answering our questions. It is okay. We appreciate everybody sending me your questions. Obviously, we can't get to them all, but nonetheless, we appreciate it. And also, I can't reply to everybody. So I apologize once again if I can't respond to you, Mike, because I don't even have a disclaimer up because it's my personal email, so I can't be putting up an auto disclaimer. Right. But just know I get your emails. I read them. I appreciate it. And we thank you for sending those in and for you, Mike, answering those questions. And with that, I want to thank you, everybody listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.